As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
South Asia is becoming a competitive showroom for defense partnerships, technology transfers, and strategic patronage. China offers speed and scale.
Yes.
Russia offers legacy systems that you mentioned and discounted arms and oil. The U.S., it's often slower and more conditional, but it still holds structural advantages that, if better leveraged, can decisively shift the regional balance in its favor.
Aloha, and welcome to Dialogue, where conversations shape security. I'm your host, James Minnick, currently United States Army retired and professor here at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. This is episode 43, South Asia's Strategic Forge. Today we turn our focus to a region that just days ago was flashing red on the global security radar, South Asia. After a deadly terrorist attack in Kashmir, India and Pakistan found themselves locked in their most expansive military confrontation in decades. Indian airstrikes reached deep into the Pakistani territory. Pakistan responded with retaliatory drone attacks and artillery shelling, and both sides pushed perilously close to open war. But now, in a matter of days, the temperature has dropped. Civilian air traffic is resuming, markets are surging, and a U.S.-brokered ceasefire appears to be holding. Still, the intensity and speed of the escalation and the fact that it happened at all tell us something important. South Asia's strategic landscape is shifting, and the risks of miscalculation are growing. This episode isn't just about the crisis we've narrowly avoided. It's about the deeper transformation reshaping the region, a strategic and industrial realignment that's influencing how South Asia relates to itself and to the broader Indo-Pacific. Power dynamics are shifting. Defense ambitions are rising, and great power competition is increasingly playing out through supply chains, joint ventures, and arms deals. At the center of this shift is India, with a rising defense budget, expanding strategic partnership, and push for self-defense reliance. India is no longer just a security partner. It is positioning itself as a pillar of regional defense industrial power. Yet it continues to pursue strategic autonomy, balancing cooperation with the United States and enduring ties with Russia. Pakistan, meanwhile, is undergoing a quieter realignment. Once a key U.S. ally, it now leans heavily on China and its deepening links with Russia. Its military remains potent, even as its defense industry lags. But perhaps more consequential than its capabilities are its shifting alignments, which could reshape regional security in unpredictable ways. And beyond India and Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and Nepal are each making moves to modernize their forces and develop modest defense industries. These decisions, while often overlooked, are where strategic influence is quietly exercised through training, financing, infrastructure, and digital dependency. Make no mistake, South Asia is now a theater of great power competition. China is expanding its military-industrial footprint. Russia remains a central player in legacy systems and energy. And the United States is seeking to deepen its role, not only through arms sales, but through industrial partnerships, technology sharing, and the pursuit of secure, trusted supply chains. In this episode, we'll explore how the United States can engage more effectively, how it can build partnerships without fueling arms races, how it can support defense modernization while respecting national sovereignty, and how it can help shape a secure, stable, and strategically aligned South Asia, grounded in mutual interests and long-term cooperation. Joining me is Professor Shyam Takwani, a leading authority on South Asia's security dynamics, political violence, and regional conflict. A former embedded photojournalist with Sri Lanka's Tamil Tigers, Shyam brings rare firsthand insight. He also co-authored two chapters in the Indo-Pacific Mosaic, India's Rise in the Indo-Pacific, Strategic Autonomy in Action, and strategic smallness in South Asia, leveraging influence among giants. Shyam Twani, welcome back to Dialogue.
Thank you, James. It's always good to be back here.
Take just a second, if you will. You've been on the show before, but share something with the audience that maybe you haven't shared before.
Well, it's hard for me to remember what I didn't share, but I'll state the obvious. I'm originally from South Asia. Spent a lot of time there as a reporter, yeah. As a journalist. Been to all those countries, covered them all, some at length, some short bursts. And it was not just about conflict. It was about politics. It was about defense. It was about entertainment. You name it. Yeah. It was comprehensive coverage.
You know, that's why there's so many things that you and I discuss and talk about, but I never get tired about hearing about your deep engagement with the region, and I learned so much from you. And as a matter of fact, you and I have been talking the last several days, as much as the region has been, about the crisis. And so let's just kind of begin there. And, you know, I want you to just take an opportunity and tell us, you know, interpret what we can learn about what's gone over the last week in this crisis, last couple of weeks.
I think, first off, what happened last week it was anticipated after the attack in Pahalgam in Kashmir on the 22nd of last month, given the fact that India's pretty much raised the bar, raised the level of responding to attacks or terrorist attacks. You know, since 2008, after the Mumbai terrorist attack, India contained itself, didn't respond militarily. But with the new administration, we saw a more muscular approach. We're seeing a more muscular approach. 2016, 2019, when India retaliated militarily.
I mean, 2019. I mean, that was not insignificant, right? I mean, not as significant as 1999, yeah. But
yeah, but it's not so much the scale and scale of the attack that we're talking
okay.
about, but the fact that enough is enough, enough of using proxies, enough of using terrorist groups to undermine, to bleed the country. This time we mean business. We're not okay. just going to let things lie. We're not going to let, you know, the old way of doing things continue, which is constrain ourselves and have conversations and dialogues. We're going to take action, and we want to demonstrate that we have the military wherewithal, we have the will, we have the capability to do it. So I think since 2016, it's 9 years now, the fact that India is raising the bar in the sense we mean business, we're going to do something. However, there's one stark difference. In the last two occasions, India did provide evidence of who the perpetrators were. This time, we haven't seen that evidence come yet. So there is some speculation that it could have been an indigenous, it could have been a homegrown group. But again, India may surprise us with evidence in the coming days. That's number one. So I think... and I think it has demonstrated. I mean, this was a strategic messaging. This was strategic yeah. messaging. You know, we'll raise the level to the point, you know, where it's just slightly below the nuclear threshold. And yeah. and this time around, India clearly demonstrated that.
Now, there's been a lot of discussion in the space about this. And I suspect there'll be much to learn as this continues to unfold. In fact, I think we'll have to have you back, and maybe in a little bit we can even talk more about what we've learned through this, on this topic specifically.
Yeah, and I don't think it's over yet. I mean,
okay.
I know that, I mean, there is a ceasefire, but that's only holding the fire. I don't think it's dissipating the tension as yet. And there's always lots of room now, given the current environment, for a misstep, a miscalculation, or even stronger reactions.
Yeah, now thank you for helping us think about that crisis like that. Let's talk a little bit about India's strategic choices. I mean, India balances its relations with the U.S., with Russia, and others, while preserving its strategic autonomy. So here's the question then. What concrete factors might pull India closer to U.S. defense industrial integration?
So yes, India's balancing act between the major powers is rooted in its pursuit of strategic autonomy, as you just mentioned earlier. And strategic autonomy is not the same as equidistance.
No.
That's something that I really want to stress. And then in recent years, there have been several concrete drivers that have begun nudging India toward deeper defense industrial alignment with the United States. And
same
I'm
one.
just referring to my notes here.
Yeah,
I wanted
same
to
one.
mention a few here. So these are not ideological shifts. I think that's important to understand. But they are strategic recalculations based on emerging realities. So if I look at the concrete drivers, number one, I would start with China as a primary strategic threat.
Okay.
And then you have Russian reliability, which is India's long-standing partner. Russian reliability in defense is in decline, primarily because of Ukraine, what Russia is involved there. And then you have India's push for self-reliance, and so which is basically a demand for co-production, technology transfer, and supply chain sovereignty. So the U.S. is uniquely positioned to meet this need through joint research and development, flexible licensing agreements, and ecosystem-to-ecosystem collaboration. And then I would say there's a fourth point would be the bureaucratic maturity and political will on both sides. Now, you've had years of foundational agreements, and I'm not going to expand them, LIMOWA, COMCASA, BICA. They've created interoperability and data sharing structures.
Okay.
They've created growing political will on both sides to move from buyer-seller dynamics to joint development, as seen in the GE fighter engine and MQ-9B drone deals that India and US did. And finally, I would say it's a shared strategic narrative about China's rise. So I think India will integrate where it sees value, but without dependency. I think that is key to their doctrine of strategic autonomy. And the U.S. will have to build that value proposition, you know, with trust, with reliability and shared strategic benefit. I think that's the answer to your question in short.
No, that's good. Without a doubt, there are a number of agreements that have been negotiated with, agreed upon with the United States. I think there'll be a discussion on on whether the agreements themselves are whether we're realizing the potential with which those agreements can expand upon to be, you know, vehicles to be much more, you know, effective in trying to bring about this shared relationship in defense industry and thing.
Well, I mentioned political will, but I'll come back to another point. It's you know, as we progress in our conversation, which is the political will is not evenly matched by bureaucratic support. So I'll come to that in a bit.
All right, fair enough. So let's talk a bit about Pakistan's global partnerships. So Pakistan's ties, I mean, they've shifted from historical U.S. reliance towards a deepening China and Russia connections. So let me ask you this question. How can the U.S. engage Pakistan selectively without upsetting the India-Pakistan balance?
Yeah, I think Pakistan's pivot from its Cold War alignment with the U.S. towards a closer strategic embrace with China, and more recently, as you pointed out, tactical engagement with Russia, it reflects a deliberate diversification of security and economic dependencies. While Pakistan may not be considered as a frontline ally, you know, from the U.S. perspective, like it was in the past.
For 20 years when we were engaged in Afghanistan.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. Absolutely. And yeah, that's right. From, I would say, from the late 70s, the first time of the Soviets and then with us. So the U.S. cannot afford to abandon the relationship entirely. And I don't think that's really feasible, especially in a region where Chinese influence is expanding unchecked. So the challenge for the U.S., when you spoke about selectively, in re-engaging Pakistan selectively, you know, in ways that serve U.S. strategic interests, without signaling equivalence with India or undermining the growing US-India partnership, it requires nuance and precision.
Yes.
And as you're aware, the fact that, I mean, just what happened a couple of days ago with the US brokered ceasefire, clearly there's a chunk of strategic thinkers and commentators in India who are very upset about the fact that this is equivalence. You know, you're making Pakistan again back. Once upon a time, there was equivalence. We got away from it. We de-hyphenated the relationship. Now there's alarm bells ringing in India that we're going back to the old order where you're hyphenating India and Pakistan again. And there's a sense of equivalence. So, which when I spoke about nuance and precision, I was referring to this business of hyphenating and equivalence. So how can the US do it selectively? Number one would be issue-based engagement over a strategic embrace, which was what we had before. And when I speak about issue-based engagement, we're looking at functional areas where there is genuine convergence,
okay,
like counterterrorism, border security, anti-narcotics cooperation. So that's issue-based. Then you have economic leverage, which can also be used as strategic leverage. Pakistan's acute debt burden, energy crisis, they provide an entry point for selective economic diplomacy. And then I mentioned earlier, no hyphenation with India. Because engagement with Pakistan, I think, must be framed especially through the lens of regional stability and countering Chinese leverage instead of India-Pakistan equivalency. And I think the fourth one, and I'm sure everybody recognizes this, and sometimes we see it in play, the pressure has to be quiet, not public. So U.S. diplomacy, again, should be firm but private. Public condemnations can harden positions and fuel anti-U.S. sentiment like it has in the past. So instead, we need calibrated conditionality tied to tangible outcomes. And I think that's possible when you have a functional relationship. So yeah, I think the U.S. recognizes both the relationships serve very different purposes. Strategic convergence with India is foundational. And selective engagement with Pakistan is instrumental. I think as long as we recognize that, then the key really is managing one without compromising the other.
Nicely said. Well, we spoke about India, we spoke about Pakistan. Let's talk about the smaller South Asian players. So Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and the others are seeking greater defense and industrial capabilities. So let me ask you the question this way. How might the U.S. offer meaningful partnerships to these smaller but pivotal states?
Yeah, I think while India commands much of the spotlight in South Asia, the smaller South Asian states, they're quietly, some of them, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, for instance, upgrading their defense ambitions and industrial aspirations. There's no question about that. Now, it's very important for everyone to recognize the fact that these small states are not passive spectators.
Yeah.
Can be strategic balancers, all of these small states. They are seeking capacity, they're seeking sovereignty, and they're seeking options amid intensifying Sino-India competition, the China-India competition, as opposed to US-China competition. From their perspective, it's an India-China competition which really affects them more than anything else. For the US, these small countries, they represent opportunities to shape the region's future architecture, if it's approached on their terms, the smaller countries' terms. And I think the way the US could do it is they can prioritize capacity building over hard power projection, unlike which has been the case most often in the past.
Yeah, when you think about capacity building, immediately my mind is going to, you've got Maldives and Sri Lanka that have a strong maritime based need or capacity requirement to be able to get after that, which is different. I mean, obviously, Nepal, Bhutan don't have those needs.
Yep.
And so when you just a pull out from you when you're talking about these capacity. I could see where, based on the negotiation, based on who you're dealing with, recognizing, understanding the specific needs and capacities that they have to build. But say more, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, these states are more interested in maritime domain awareness, disaster resilience, border surveillance, cybersecurity, peacekeeping support, and then in major arm transfers.
That's right.
So their requirements are very different from
quite different.
The giant in the region, which is India. Then I think the second thing the U.S. could do is elevate industrial and technological cooperation. Now, Bangladesh, they have something called the Forces Goal 2030. And this was originally enunciated in 2009. And then by 2017, it became an official policy of sorts. Sri Lanka's push. There's a push in Sri Lanka for indigenous defense procurement. Now, all these offer entry points for joint production, maintenance partnerships, and logistics support hubs. The U.S. firms, especially in UAVs and maritime systems, they could partner with local industries.
That's right. No, I think you're onto something that we recognize, based on location and proximity to operating locations allows to take advantage of certain things. And you talk about there could be maintenance opportunities there or logistic opportunities there. And as we think through those and where they're located, then there's an opportunity to work with them, be able to understand their needs, understand our needs, and be able to match the two and not be, struck by it's a smaller state. What is the relationship here? But understand there is much to be gained. No, I think you're right on it.
Right. And then the last point I would like to make in this context is, and I made that in the chapter that you referred to, a small South Asian states, which is, I think the U.S. is in a position to empower regional minilateralism.
Yes.
And I think I keep reiterating this. I may have said this in the two earlier times we spoke. And I wrote that in the chapter, which is these countries have to be seen on their terms. As I said, they're strategic enablers. They're not just hangers-on. And they would like to be seen not through the prism of India's strategic lens, but for what they can bring to the table, for what they are. I think that's something I know the U.S. has begun recognizing and acting on it, but I would suggest we double down on it, even more. The U.S. needs to do that a little more and give them, recognize that they have agency and demonstrate that they have agency by giving them a place at the table.
No, very well said.
So I think this, in bottom line, is the smaller states, they want partnerships that respect their agency and that can expand their capacity and that could also reduce the dependency. Right now, they probably feel dependent on one of the two countries, either China or India. So,
Let's pull on a little bit about, now we've talked the countries in the sub-region. Let's talk though about South Asia's industrial base. South Asian defense industries, I mean, they show both ambition and but key gaps, especially in indigenous production. So I might ask, how can the U.S. tailor technological cooperation then to meet these local needs?
I'm glad you mentioned there's rising ambition, but which is constrained by capacity gaps. Mm. Import dependencies, there's one, and even uneven ecosystems. I'm talking about defense ecosystems. While India leads this shift, the transformation in South Asia, countries like Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, even Nepal, now they are seeking to localize production. They want to indigenize maintenance, and they want to modernize procurement, which is the minimum any country would want. For the U.S., I think this is a strategic opening to deepen partnerships, not by selling more, which has been the
case, right?
But by building capacity, by co-developing platforms and embedding trust into their supply chains. Now, a few examples. I think the U.S. can recognize the diversity of industrial needs. Like I go back to the earlier point I made, recognize what they need, not give them what you think India would like them to have, for instance. So India is pursuing complex joint development, jet engines, naval systems, drones, while the others seek modest upgrades in logistics, surveillance, cybersecurity. Then they got to move beyond the foreign military sales model, the FMS model. Something like a tailored defense trade and technology initiative pathways, pre-cleared tech transfer components and offset frameworks. They're more adaptive to local needs. And I think more important is aligned with national agendas. Again, don't look at it through the prism of some other country in the region.
Yeah.
So US companies, they can co-produce under the self-reliant India campaign, which we speak about often. But in Bangladesh, U.S. firms can support Forces Goal 2030 through maintenance hubs, radar upgrades, and local assembly partnerships. So I think bottom line again is South Asia just doesn't need equipment. It needs industrial partnerships that respect sovereignty, build trust, enhance self-reliance. I think if the U.S. is able to tailor this engagement accordingly, it will not just find buyers, but I think enduring partners.
Nicely said. So let's take what you said, though, but let's put it through the lens of great power competition. I mean, China, Russia, and the United States, they all use arms sales and tech transfers to shape the region. So here's a question. What competitive advantages can the U.S. apply to outpace its rivals?
I'm glad you said that, because South Asia is becoming a competitive showroom for defense partnerships, technology transfers, and strategic patronage. China offers speed and scale.
Yes.
Russia offers legacy systems that you mentioned and discounted arms and oil. The U.S., it's often slower and more conditional, but it still holds structural advantages that, if better leveraged, can decisively shift the regional balance in its favor. Number one, I think, edge when I speak about technological edge still matters, if accessible. Now, the U.S. continues to lead in next generation systems. Now, whether it's AI integrated platforms, undersea warfare, space, cyber, secure communications, the challenge is not capability, but accessibility. And South Asian partners will gravitate to the U.S. when technology comes with fewer restrictions. In the past, it's been tied to different issues and joint innovation opportunities. And then the other one would be, you got to embed an ecosystem, not just hardware. So traditional foreign military sales often mismatches U.S. timelines and South Asian bureaucracies and fiscal constraints, of course. So I think if we are, and I go back, stop thinking more on FMS, think more about embedded ecosystems. I think that's where we have a competitive edge, that the U.S. has a competitive edge.
Okay, nicely said. Let's talk supply chain resilience. Secure, resilient supply chains are central to joint defense production and trusted partnerships. So how can the U.S. strengthen co-production and reduce regional dependency on China?
So for a start, supply chains are no longer just economic pathways. They're now geopolitical battlegrounds.
Yeah.
In South Asia, China has embedded itself deeply into defense adjacent supply chains like electronics, rare earths, dual use components, and digital infrastructure. Now for the US, enabling a resilient China-free defense co-production is not just a technical task, it's a strategic imperative. So I think one is you got to identify and secure strategic bottlenecks. Many South Asian states, especially India, they depend on China for critical subcomponents. Now, whether it's avionics, electronics, solar cells, optical sensors, and rare earths. I think the US should work with India and the regional partners, the small states, to map these vulnerabilities. They got to prioritize choke points and co-develop alternatives through targeted funding and industrial collaboration. I think that's one way. Number two is embed U.S. firms into South Asian supply ecosystems. So U.S. Firms must move from being exporters to co-creators.
Okay.
strategic joint ventures, parts assembly plants, and then you have maintenance, repair, overhaul centers. They can anchor trust and industrial capacity. And then you can, the US can also incentivize second tier and third tier suppliers to partner with vetted, you know, South Asian manufacturers who have been vetted and de-risk production and localize value chains. So I think bottom line is it co-producing with South Asia, it has to invest in co-resilience.
Yeah, now the earlier when you were talking about the various agreements, bilateral agreements, I was thinking about there would clearly be opportunities to expand on those agreements. The frameworks are there, but to really now, you know, get after some of this co-production in a manner that you've been describing is another step to be taken. And so how do we leverage the work that's been done to create these various agreements and now get in and really, with some specificity, start fleshing these out clearly in co-production and other areas?
But yep.
Well, let's talk a little bit then on alliances and interoperability. So industrial cooperation, I mean, it directly supports broader security architectures like the Quad and other ones. And so what steps are needed to boost military interoperability through joint platforms and systems?
I go back at the risk of repeating myself, which is industrial cooperation is not just about manufacturing. It's about embedding. I keep using the word embedding. And what do we embed when I speak about shared ecosystems? You need shared doctrines,
okay,
shared standards, and trust into the systems that allies use together. In South Asia, particularly with India and Quad adjacent partners, military interoperability must evolve beyond symbolic exercises.
I'm going to hold you there just for a second, and then we'll pick back up. When I was thinking about this shared doctrine and this embed and this really working together, You probably know I spent a career in and out of Korea, and I graduated their Army Staff College and then their National Defense University. And I had really saw how the doctrine and the tactics which the U.S. had developed was being really embraced and taught there. And I thought nowhere had I been and saw, I mean, really a interoperability which was unique among allies and partnerships. And so when you're talking about this degree of shared doctrine and tactics and you know, even taking it beyond just coming together and exercising, that's where my mind goes to that type of.
So then I have a question for you. When it can work in South Korea, why is it a problem elsewhere?
And of course, you know, the relationship with South Korea is a bit unique. They have a combined force there that they really, in earnest, practice this type of interoperability that you're speaking about. Of course, they also, over time, have progressively looked to, you know, rise in their own production. But there's been a lot of co-production, and that's kind of where you're getting at, is how do we create relationships that are really deeper and thicker and have a codependency with them? And I didn't want to pull you off too much, but my mind was, you know, I wanted to foot stomp your points about this.
Great. Yeah, it's related. So I think it's good to have an example from outside South Asia. So I was talking about, and I go back to what you just mentioned, it has to move beyond symbolic exercises into real functional integration of systems, software, and training. I think there are ways to do it. Number one is co-develop and co-produce interoperable platforms. You know, prioritize joint production of platforms already suited for shared missions, UAVs, systems, I mean, logistics vessels, cyber defense nodes, and secure communications, which I mentioned earlier. So the goal should not just be commonality, but complementarity. Enabling force multiplication across diverse operational doctrines. Number two, expand joint training, testing, and war gaming. Sorry. True interoperability is built through repetition.
Yeah.
increase joint trails of co-produced systems, integrate Indian and other South Asian officers into U.S. war colleges, simulate Quad missions with South Asian participation. And I think the third one, I think it's quite critical. You build Indo-Pacific defense tech corridors, support the creation of Indo-Pacific tech corridors, digital and physical infrastructure that links innovation labs, startups across the U.S., India, Japan, and partner South Asian states. It's not just the U.S.
Right.
bearing the onus. And this ecosystem-centric approach will allow plug-and-play interoperability, even if full alignment is politically difficult. So I think, bottom line again, to achieve true regional interoperability, the U.S. must co-create not just tools, but operational trust across industrial, digital, and doctrinal layers.
Hmm. That's comprehensive. Let's think now towards future paths and risks. The next decade holds opportunities and risks for South Asia's strategic alignments. So what forces could accelerate or derail deeper U.S. defense and industrial partnerships?
You mentioned at the outset, the region is on the cusp of strategic transformation. There's ambition, there's insecurity, there's great power rivalry. They all converge. So the next decade actually, based off last week's events, offers a window of opportunity for the U.S. to deepen defense industrial partnerships. But again, I go back to the earlier point, the terrain is uneven.
Yeah.
The ecosystem's uneven. And the forces at play are very fluid. Some could accelerate cooperation. Others could derail it. Now, in terms of opportunities and accelerators, I think there's a rising threat convergence with China. Across the board, South Asian states, they increasingly see the U.S. They share the U.S. threat perception.
Yeah.
This convergence could fast-track tech transfer, intelligence sharing, co-development in sensitive domains like space, cyber, undersea warfare. Number two could be industrial maturity. You see that in India, and it's happening even in some of the smaller states. India is evolving defense industrial ecosystem. Bangladesh's forces goal 2030. They offer platforms for joint ventures, co-production, shared logistics. Now, the risks and derailers, I would probably start with strategic drift.
Yeah.
Or political instability. Strategic drift on the part of the U.S., political instability in South Asia. Now, we have shifting U.S. administrations on domestic crisis in partner countries, India and Pakistan, for instance. They could disrupt momentum.
Yeah.
They could deprioritize the Indo-Pacific. And then the other factor I would mention here is, partnerships built on personal rapport rather than institutional continuity are particularly vulnerable. And, a couple of examples in the region. And then the other derailer risk is the divergence on Russia, Iran, and sanctioned regimes. So India's balancing act, especially its deep ties with Russia, they could cause friction, as they have in the past a bit, particularly over sanctions or having parallel supply chains. And then the last one is slow bureaucracy. You often find, between administrations, you can have political will, but if the bureaucracy is opposed to a certain shift in policy or even relationship, if it's entrenched, they can slow it down. And when it gets slow, you break the momentum.
Yeah.
So I think the future of U.S. and South Asia defense industrial ties, they hinge on three factors: strategic clarity, bureaucratic agility, and political reliability.
That's a good construct. Well, this has been a good deep dive into understanding more about the South Asia's strategic and industrial development in the trajectory. We got several audience questions that have come in for this episode, and so let's take some of those. Not surprisingly, there's several here about the crisis, and so let's ask this one on the post-crisis calculus. What does the speed and scale of the recent escalation tell us about India's evolving strategic posture, and how might this reshape future conflict thresholds?
I alluded earlier to the fact that, I didn't get the question.
So basically, with the rapidity that with India went, what can we take from that with when we think about future conflict thresholds?
Well, I think we're going to see, and this is a scary part, we're going to see greater room for miscalculation and missteps. But from India's perspective, it definitely, from its perspective, I'm not saying it right or wrong, I'm not being judgmental here, but the fact that we have been dealing with this issue of terrorism, we've been over and proxy actors for a very long time, it has to stop. From India's perspective, again, it really wants to clearly be, punch above its weight. It's not punching above its weight. And right or wrong, they seem to think that what's holding them back is a troublesome neighbor. And so that their message is, we have had enough, we're going to deal with this even more seriously than we have in the past. And even if that means going to war, we're going to do it. And I think for the region, that's not a good thing. And unless and until the U.S. stepped in to basically sponsor a ceasefire, to mandate, to underwrite the ceasefire, things could have spiraled out of control.
Yeah.
I think that's what we're going to see more and more. If there's the next one, might not be as pretty as the recent one was.
Yeah.
I mean, I wish I could talk more about it, but you know, everything is still very foggy. We don't have too much of information, but it's correct information. There's lots of stuff out there, but I think India wanted to make a point to its domestic base, to its neighbor, and also internationally, that we have the capability, we have a will, and that we will do what it takes to make sure nothing more holds us back from reaching our potential as a regional power.
So I want to pull a little bit more on what you're talking here with this next question that's asking about information operations. And so and basically how India and Pakistan used that IO, that information operation, to shape its domestic and its international narratives.
Yeah, I think the one thing that was very clear was the speed at which both the countries used information operations, whether they were hashtags or memes or social media or even the media, I mean, in mainstream media, both were quick off the mark. And the narratives were slightly different from India's. India's narrative was we're trying to set a wrong right. We're trying to make sure that this doesn't happen again, and that we were the victims. I mean, we had a terrorist attack. Again, I go back to the point that this is the first time we haven't seen evidence come out to basically say the proxies came from the neighboring country. And so all India's messaging was definitely that we can do, we have the military capability. And it goes back to making sure that the domestic audience understood that, and the international community also saw that India was very serious. From Pakistan's side, it achieved a couple of objectives. It internationalized the issue of Kashmir, which India was very loath to do, because they see it as a bilateral issue that has to be resolved between India and Pakistan. But the Pakistan's information operations was able to bring it back to international visibility, number one. Number two, it portrayed itself as a victim. Again, most of its messaging was for both domestic audiences as well as international community. And,
you know, when I think about information operation, just the name of the operation comes to mind, Operation Sindoor.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that has meaning.
It has
maybe
meaning.
Maybe it might.
So we had some of the victims, I mean, some of the people who died in the attack on April 22nd in Pahalgam in Kashmir, the terrorist attack. They were young men. Some of them, I think at least one was recently married. And Sindoor is the red vermilion, red powder, which women in India often use to denote that they're married.
Yes.
And so it was very appropriate in terms of emotional resonance with a country. You couldn't have found a better name to get the country to rally around you. It was emotionally charged.
Right.
And so it was basically the operation was named after the red powder, which married women. In this case, a very young widow. She'd lost her husband within a week of marrying. They were there on a honeymoon. Yeah. So it packed a punch in terms of rallying the nation around and all that stuff. Yeah.
No, well said. The information operation was used throughout in many,
yeah,
many ways.
Yeah, and both of them did.
Yeah, both of them did, of course.
And I think both, to some degree, achieved the goals that they were looking to achieve. Though, you know, Pakistan information essentially was to depict India as the aggressor, and India's was to depict Pakistan as the culprit.
Yep.
And so the kind of images that started coming out from Pakistan, you had images of, you know, people injured, people killed. So they were kind of victims, civilians. From India's perspective, they played up this whole Sindoor narrative, the Kashmir narrative.
There's seems to be several questions on this, but not surprisingly. This next one is asking about U.S. Mediation. And so we spoke a little bit about that, but the U.S. played a key role in brokering the ceasefire. So the question really is, did its engagement approach enhance the United States' influence in the region in the long term?
I think it would have, that's my view, it might have damaged the U.S.'s influence in the region had it not stepped in. And I think, I know that India is not particularly happy when that's being put out there, that it was the U.S. which essentially made sure that there was a ceasefire. But it was important for the U.S. to step in. And if you look at it, in the past, every time India and Pakistan have come to the edge of war or even in the middle of a war, it's always been an outside player.
Yeah.
And it's the outside player has always been the U.S., which has been able to pull them apart. And like it or not, India and Pakistan cannot, I don't see them being able to resolve this issue by themselves. One may want to internationalize the issue, the other may want to make it purely bilateral, but I do not foresee this problem as being resolvable bilaterally. It was important for the U.S. to step in just when it did. Initially, it seemed like it was hesitant, it didn't want to, but when it started spiraling out of control and reaching certain thresholds, it had to step in.
You know, when the stakes are as high as they are, the interest is core, it often takes a mediator to be able to help people see.
And this
logically.
Is proven time and again. I mean, you can call them serial offenders. I mean, every time they've been at each other's throats, it has involved an external power, and that external power has been U.S.
Yeah, oh, nicely said. This next question asking about counterterrorism lessons. And so it's, you know, given your experience in Sri Lanka, what long-term strategies could India adopt to counter externally supported terrorism without fueling this prolonged cycles of escalation?
Okay, so Sri Lanka's probably its counterinsurgency approach probably the most decisive ever in I would say probably modern history, but it's also controversial. So if you look at what India could benefit, we know what India could take out of that experience. What did Sri Lanka do differently? It demonstrated political will. It demonstrated alignment. It demonstrated interagency cooperation, whether it was the police, military, civil society. It's not that India doesn't have, pardon me, India doesn't have the capability. It's just that it's not been able to get its interagency cooperation, interagency agencies converging and acting as one. Then the other part of Sri Lanka's counter-insurgency operations was its ability to integrate intelligence. I mean, they really stepped up on their intelligence gathering, which I think, again, India's, I mean, you can argue that what happened in Kashmir on April 22nd was a classic, I mean, you could argue it was a case of intelligence failure. So I think intelligence gathering is number two, which Sri Lanka was able to achieve. So there's interagency cooperation, intelligence gathering. And if I look at what are the other lessons India can take back from that operation, from Sri Lanka's counter-insurgency operations. Now, just because you've defeated an adversary, it does not mean the issue is over.
No.
So unless you have accountability, unless you have justice, if you look at India, what's happening in Manipur, northeast of India, or even if you look at the left-wing extremist movements called the Naxalite movement, you'll see India has been successful in some cases where after having defeated a particular corner of the country where Naxalites reigned supreme, there's been success, long success. I'm talking of strategic success, not tactical success, that we have knocked off 50 guys and so on and so forth, where they have built schools, roads, where there's been development. Now, if you don't follow up your tactical victories with long-term governance, enabling governance structures, you're not going to last long. I mean, that victory is not going to last long. And we're seeing that repeatedly. Manipur is a case in point. It's not something that erupted. It erupted again. It re-erupted. It's been a long-standing issue. And I think that's one thing that India can take back from Sri Lanka's is, you've got to follow through your tactical victories with strategic enablers that will ensure that it's truly successful and not just you can't measure and count success by body count or seizing territory.
No, well said. This next question is asking about India's regional image. So how can India balance rising military and industrial power with the need to build trust among smaller South Asian neighbors who remain perhaps weary of its intentions?
Yeah, that's my pet topic.
Yeah, I know it is. This one question is made for you.
Yeah. And I'm sure much has been said about it in the past. I'll repeat this. I think India's approach has to be inclusive. And not the role of a dominant power. I'm not suggesting that India, reduce its power and all that stuff. When you have power, you have responsibility, and that responsibility has to be displayed. And how do you display that kind of responsibility? Inclusiveness is one. It's not my way or the highway. And if you don't do it my way, you're going to get punished for it. Like the economic blockade in Nepal in 2015, that springs to mind because I happened to be there when this happened. And there are many similar examples in the region. Each of these countries will give you a long list of experiences. So I think it's treating them with respect, understanding that they also are sovereign nations and not somebody's adjuncts or appendages. And I believe that if India made efforts to align each of the country's interests with its own instead of dictating that their interests be aligned with India's alone, it will go a long way. Just making sure that both are aligned as opposed to you got to do it because it has to align with mine. You kind of shoehorn it. And that,
yeah.
And I think, I'm sure it understands that it doesn't need to be told.
Right.
But why it keeps failing to do that is a mystery for me. But I think the bottom line is it's got to be inclusive, got to treat them respectfully, understand that they're also sovereign nations. Size doesn't matter. You can't be harping about civilizational linkages and relationships when you see it veering off to in search of another partner. It doesn't work that way. It has to be consistent. It has to, if you're going to talk about civilizational linkages and long relationships, you prove it. You treat it with respect and not as an appendage.
Let's take one more question. This one's asking about strategic identity. So as India navigates partnerships with the US, Russia, and others, does its multi-alignment strategy, does that strengthen its leverage, or does it risk diluting its long-term strategic clarity?
It cuts both ways.
Okay.
I think they strengthen it because you're not putting all your eggs in one basket. You're ensuring that you're, if not the supply chain, another supply chain and all that stuff, there's strength and there's value in it. But I think increasingly, when you're looking for multi-partners and then you're looking at developing this solid relationship with a power like the United States, you can come across like you're hedging, you can come across like you're... what's the word for it? You're undecided, you're uncertain, but hedging would probably
right.
Be the word I'm looking for. And I think it's not just India. I would think, given the current state of the the state of the world, multi-alignment is the way to go. Even if whether you're small or big. Whatever your size be, I think we have all learned from recent history, from your recent experiences, that you can't be aligned with one power or the other. And I'm not talking about big powers alone. And I think the strategy of multi-alignment is very good, but then you've got to also step up when you're asked to step up, especially if you want to be a player on the world stage and not appear as indecisive or hedging.
Shyam, again, this has been a masterclass in better understanding South Asia. So thank you very much for this time. But before we let you go, I wonder if you could share book recommendations with the audience.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me back, James. It's always a pleasure talking with you. You know that. I have a couple of books. I have written them down, which is what I was looking at. But first, I'd like to recommend this book. Now, it's called Arming Without Aiming.
Okay.
It's India's Military Modernization by Stephen Cowan and Sunil Dasgupta. A caveat, this is not a recent book. This is about 15 years old, 2010, before India's self-reliant move and India and the US relationship. But it gives you a basic understanding. But I haven't seen a book that comes as close to this as outlining and analyzing India's military modernization. The other book, if I find it here, I wrote it down. I'm afraid I don't have a copy. It's by Ashley Tellis.
I don't think he needs an introduction. He's a friend of the center.
Yeah, he is a friend. It's called India's Emerging Defense Policy, A Deepening Partnership with the United States. I think it complements this book very well. And I would recommend that if both the books are read together, we'll have a full picture, a clear picture.
Again, thank you, Shyam, for being here.
Thank you so much, James, and thanks everyone for listening.
Absolutely. As we conclude today's dialogue, one thing is clear. South Asia's strategic realignments and rising defense ambitions will shape the Indo-Pacific for years to come. Understanding these shifts and engaging wisely is essential for those committed to regional stability and cooperation. These conversations shape security. Join us next time on May 28th when I sit down with two national defense leaders, Malaysia's Hogila Devi Radhakrishnan and the Philippines' Angelito Castillo, to explore how strategies, collaboration, and industrial pathways shape defense development in both countries. On behalf of all of us at Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies, thank you for being part of this important conversation. I'm James Minnick, and until we meet again, aloha oe. As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI, APCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.